Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's webinar with Moms Fighting Autism. Today's topic is the influence of rhythm on movement in autism based on a model of cerebellar dysfunction. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism and have been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of 4. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistant technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There are two ways to participate in today's webinar. You can go to momsfightingautism.com. The webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, and there you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet, or click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and entering conference ID number 541. Well, the conference ID is on the website. Let me get that for you while I'm talking here. I don't want to give you the wrong one. So,
I think I have it, Nancy.
Well, I think we have the one that's for the presenters.
Okay.
So we can't share that with everybody. But the number is 949-333-4806. And I will get the conference ID number as we go along here. But all callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let telephone listeners know how they can ask a question directly to our presenters if they wish. We try to get to as many of the questions and the common topics as we can in the time we have allotted, but I'll let you know how you can contact the speaker directly afterwards so you can ask questions if you need to. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It takes about 16 seconds to connect, so don't worry, it will connect. And once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. There's going to be an extra little button on your blue box that says View the Videos, so we will prompt you when to do that. And, I haven't found the number, so I will as we go along here, and I will announce that soon. So today we're talking about the influence of rhythm on movement and autism based on the model of cerebellar dysfunction with Michelle Hardy. Michelle Hardy is a board-certified music therapist. She's a fellow of the Academy of Neurologic Music Therapy, and she has received her master's degree from Colorado State University. She is the program director for Chris's Camp, an intensive therapy camp for children with autism and their families, and founded the Arizona branch of Chris's Camp in 2002. Michelle currently has a private practice in San Diego, serving persons with autism and sensory integration dysfunction. Prior to relocating to San Diego in 2010, Michelle worked in a variety of locations, providing individual and group therapy sessions to children and adults with autism, developmental disabilities, and other neurological impairments in home-based clinics and educational settings. These positions included Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona for a total of 8 years, Summit Music Therapy Services in Colorado for 2 years, and LaForche Parish Schools in Louisiana for 3 years. Michelle received her bachelor's degree in music therapy from Loyola University in New Orleans in 1995. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Good morning, everybody. So as Nancy said, I have worked as a clinician for over 15 years now, and kind of the focus of my work has been with children with autism. And in 1998, I had an opportunity to move to Phoenix and work for a wonderful organization, Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona, where I first looked at autism and movement differences as related to this diagnosis. And movement differences in autism is pretty controversial. If you ask someone, are there movement issues in autism, most people will say no, and that's based on the diagnostic information that we have currently. So for my master's thesis, I did a lit review looking at basically what brain abnormalities might explain movement issues that we have seen clinically, and what does research say about movement in autism? Is there research that supports that there are differences in movement? And then if there are movement differences, would rhythm, because I'm a neurologic music therapist, would rhythm be a useful tool to accommodate those differences? So I just completed my master's about 2 weeks ago. I started my work towards this in 2003, and then three children later, I finally finished this semester, and I had the unique opportunity to have Temple Grandin sit on my committee from Colorado State University. So at the end of my presentation, I have two videos of her actually doing some of one specific drum intervention that we use in neurologic music therapy. So stay with me and look forward to that. So this is entitled The Influence of Rhythm on Movement in Autism Based on a Model of Cerebellar Dysfunction.
Hey, Michelle,
so you all know the...
I'm sorry, while you're taking a breath, I found the number.
Okay, go.
Okay, so if you want to participate by phone, please phone 949-333-4806, and the participant ID is 792-094-pound. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So you all know the diagnostic criteria of autism, that there are three main deficits: a qualitative impairment in social interaction, a qualitative impairment in communication, and restricted repetitive and stereotype patterns of behaviors, interests, and activities. And that's often where you see the motor disturbances. But keep those three factors in mind. I completely agree that those are three deficits in autism. But as we look at this, I believe that movement disturbances and differences may be underlying all of those other deficits. So Leo Kanner in 1943 was the first to define autism. And he was an Austrian psychiatrist and physician. And so the tools that he had were behavioral psychology. So that explains why it is purely behavioral criteria. At the time, they weren't at all looking at movement. It's the progression of autism has been psychological to genetic. It's long been considered a psychogenic disease, which is a mental disease or an emotional disease. But in 1977, they had their first twin reports of children with autism, and you can see there are further dates, 1985 and 1988. So at this point, since 2003, they believe that genetic factors may influence abnormal brain development. And so the question now is, what particular genes are involved? What is the role that those genes play, and the influence of interaction between genes and the environment? And it's exciting that you can influence behavior. The brain has plasticity, and so early intervention and really intervention at any point can change the brain, which we'll discuss later. So based on genes, that influences brain development. So there is a genetic predisposition or susceptibility to autism. You see atypical brain development involving the basal ganglia, the brainstem, the cerebellum, frontal lobes, the limbic system, and the parietal lobes. These are both functional abnormalities and structural abnormalities. But for the purposes of my master's thesis and for this presentation, the most robust finding is the cerebellum. Now, it looks like there should be a picture on there. I'm not sure if people are seeing the picture. I am not on my screen. Nancy, is there a picture?
I'm not seeing it on mine either. I'm sorry.
Well, there's a great picture of the brain, so just imagine. But the cerebellum is basically above your brainstem, which is in the back lower part of your brain. So back above your neck, basically the back of your brain. So to understand the deficits that in autism that might be shown through cerebellar abnormalities, we have to first look at what is the neurotypical cerebellum, how does it respond? So in the typical cerebellum, it's the largest structure in the human brain. It has widely connected loops. It has a high input to output axon ratio of 40 cerebellar afferents to one efferent. What that means is there are 40 incoming signals to one output signal. So there's a lot that comes in and one that goes out. And traditionally, it's considered solely a motor structure. And that's largely based on observations of individuals with cerebellar damage due to stroke or traumatic brain injury and the subsequent motor disturbances that are observed in that. The organization of the cerebellum is very distinct and unique. Excuse me, there are three main areas of the cerebellum: the vestibulocerebellum, the cerebrocerebellum, and the spinocerebellum. And each of those distinct locations have a responsibility for our movement and our pretty much everything we do, and we'll talk about that. But the vestibulocerebellum is responsible for eye movements and balance, and it's related to posture and gait, which is walking. Cerebrocerebellum, it coordinates the planning and the initiation of movement. And the spinocerebellum receives information from the auditory, visual, and vestibular systems and adjusts ongoing movements based on external sensory feedback. So the next slide is a great picture of this organization. So just imagine that you're seeing this wonderful picture. So the organization of those three areas demonstrates that the cerebellum's main function is to adjust the output of the motor systems and act as a comparator that compensates for errors in movement by comparing intention with performance. So you decide, I'm going to walk across the room. My intention is to walk across the room. So as I'm walking, if the trajectory of my movement is not correct, the cerebellum is going to compensate and adjust and help me modulate that movement. So based on connectivity in the loops from the cerebellum, it is not limited to motor, but must function in both a general and highly integrative manner. And findings suggest that the cerebellum may be responsible for purposes within multiple domains, inclusive of cognition, sensory, affect, and motor functions. So the cerebellum is not only involved in motor control and motor skill acquisition, but studies have also shown that it is involved in attention, associative learning, practice-related learning, procedural learning, declarative and working memory, semantic association, conditioned anxiety, mental exploration, complex reasoning, and problem solving. And I'm just going to throw out here, I'm putting these things in here because the cerebellum, abnormalities in the cerebellum can impact a lot of different things. But for the purposes of this paper, I'm going to focus primarily on movement. So there's been a constant question, what is the role of the cerebellum? And again, based on acquired damage to the cerebellum, they see motor differences. So it's been widely accepted that the cerebellum is involved in motor. So the cerebellum plans and adjusts and executes movements of the body, the limbs, the eyes, and therefore, paired with anatomical data, the cerebellum's role is consistent in motor control and adaptation. The cerebellum is involved with automatizing and optimizing functions around a homeostatic baseline. So it is balancing based on cognitive, emotional, and or motor context. So Schmaman and Pandya in 2008, their research indicates that the cerebellum coordinates cognition and emotional functions as well in the same way that it regulates and controls motor activity. So the cerebellum serves not as a motor mechanism, a sensory mechanism, or a cognitive mechanism, but instead as a general purpose device that predicts the neural systems needed for a particular motor or non-motor operation and then prepares for the operation at hand. So when we look at damage to the cerebellum or pathology in the cerebellum, cerebellar injured patients can still move. They can still walk. They can still do motor tasks, but they display uncoordinated movement adaptation deficits, modulation difficulty. They either overshoot the movement or they undershoot the movement, and they show suboptimal performance due to lack of preparatory role. So as we look further in autism at movement disturbances, the research shows, remember this. In autism, there is abnormal development of the cerebellum. It is going to be different than a stroke or traumatic brain injury, but we do see similarities. So at this point, we are looking at what are those similarities in movement, and then how can we address those in therapy. So the cerebellum in autism, it's one of the most consistent sites of neuroanatomic abnormality. The cerebellum size in patients with autism increased with age in both typical children, and in children with autism. However, these structures were significantly smaller in autism. They showed hyperplasia or hypoplasia of cerebellar hemispheres. Hyperplasia is excessive enlargement, and hypoplasia is under or incomplete development. The majority of what they saw was hypoplasia of the cerebellum and of cerebellar vermis. In 1998, there were findings that there were two subtypes of vermian abnormality in all age groups with autism. There are vermal lobules 1 through 7 in the cerebellum, and the specific abnormalities found were in vermal lobules 6 and 7. And again, they showed hyperplasia or hypoplasia, but the most consistent was hypoplasia or under or incomplete development of these lobules. Now, cerebellar volume, as I said, is smaller in autism than compared to someone that has typical development. But the volume is greatly determined by the largest neuron in the cerebellum, the Purkinje cell. And therefore, hypoplasia of the cerebellum may suggest a neuronal deficit. And sure enough, one of the most reproducible findings is a reduction of these Purkinje neurons. This neuron is the primary output from the cerebellum and projects directly to every major motor structure in the brain. And if you remember from a few slides ago, 40 signals are coming in while one is going out. So that Purkinje neuron is critical to the way we interact in our environment. These neurons are the only known neurons that send output from the cerebellar cortex and have been implicated in motor coordination, learning, and cognitive functions. Purkinje neurons receive excitatory synapses from extracerebellar locations and inhibitory input from within the cerebellum. So information's coming in and exciting the cerebellum, and the cerebellum inside is inhibiting and saying, okay, don't respond to that, don't react to that, don't do it, and then is able to adjust in the moment based on external stimuli. This dramatic reduction of Purkinje neurons may lead to disinhibition of the cerebellar deep nuclei and thus overexcitement of the thalamus and the cerebral cortex. One of the main loops that we know about from the cerebellum goes through the thalamus and the basal ganglia to the frontal lobe. And so it is this great loop that goes all the way around to those areas and back. And one of the things that we see in autism is, you know, those repetitive behaviors. What we're seeing is those loops get stuck. And so from the thalamus to the frontal lobe, there's this constant repetition of the same pattern. And that is where they think that is happening. So there's what's called an early brain overgrowth in autism. And reduction of those Purkinje cells or Purkinje neurons may explain this overgrowth. Total brain volume is observed postnatally in autism, and then due to this overgrowth, there's subsequent atypical mapping and connectivity. Head circumference of children with autism has been clinically identified to be either normal or slightly small at birth, but then there's an abnormally accelerated growth during early to mid-childhood. So those Purkinje neurons are a site for the expression of MHC class 1, and this expression is responsible for pruning those unneeded synaptic connections. So the brain is always pruning the things that we don't need and, you know, cleaning up those pathways that we do need. And so this decreased expression here will impact how the brain operates and the development. And what happens in this process is you see an overgrowth of localized cortical connections and an undergrowth of more distant connections. So the further the path from the cerebellum to the basal ganglia all the way to the frontal lobe, that there's an undergrowth there. So that connectivity is going to be atypical. It's going to be different than in the typical brain. They've seen increased white matter volumes within primary motor cortices, and there's a relationship that's been demonstrated between increased white matter volume and poor motor functioning. So the greater the white matter found, they are seeing greater motor function, motor dysfunction. And this association appeared specific to autism. They looked also at Asperger's syndrome, and that did not seem to apply to Asperger's. So overgrowth, this early overgrowth based on the lack of Purkinje neurons, may impact motor. Motor dysfunction may be a result of abnormally developing white matter at a young age in children with autism. And this connectivity may contribute to impaired motor sequence learning necessary for development of complex motor skills and gestures. So now we're going to look at movement in autism. What does the research tell us? What are they seeing in autism? Are they seeing motor disturbances that are similar to what we see when there's been damage to the cerebellum or pathology? So as you know, motor disturbances are not a formal part of the diagnosis of autism. However, neurological dysfunction may be associated with abnormal movement seen in individuals with autism. Motor dysfunction may be the basis for some of the core features of autism. And what I think this is a great definition of a movement disturbance. It is an interference in the efficient, ineffective use of movement that cannot be accounted for by paralysis or weakness synonymous with a disruption in the regulation of movement. We'll come back to that because I think Donnellan's definition there is really, really great. But I think it's important to put out there, as I mentioned in the beginning, there is controversy about whether there are movement differences in autism. This is a quote by Rimland in 1993. It has been widely recognized for many decades that the vast majority of autistic persons are quite unimpaired with regard to their finger dexterity and gross motor capabilities. They have, in fact, been described as especially dexterous and coordinated. The literature abounds with stories of young autistic children who can take apart and reassemble small mechanical devices, build towers of blocks and dominoes higher than a normal adult can, assemble jigsaw puzzles, and climb to dangerously high places without falling. The idea that autism is or typically involves a movement disorder is simply ludicrous. So Rimland supports a lot of people. A lot of people agree with him that there are not movement differences in autism. Now, 1993 to 2011, there's been a lot of research done that is allowing us to look at what is going on in movement in autism. So in 1943, I mentioned Leo Kanner. He identified movement disturbances. And a lot of these things you're going to see as I talk about recent research. He saw clumsiness in gait and gross motor performances. He saw a failure to assume an anticipatory posture as mothers would go up to lift their children up. Their children did not initiate that anticipatory response that their mom was going to pick them up. They showed passive positioning like a sack of flour. In some cases, they lacked the ability to adjust their body to the person holding them. And their verbal utterances and motor performances were monotonous and repetitive, resulting in marked limitation in the variety of spontaneous activity. So keep those in mind as we look forward at observed motor impairments in autism. The four main areas that research has identified is clumsiness and poor coordination, gait abnormalities, impaired performance of skilled motor tasks, and motor planning deficits. Many of the studies regarding movement disturbance support the theory that motor deficits observed in autism are associated, at least in part, to cerebellar dysfunction. So for the purposes of this presentation and for my master's thesis, I really looked at what movements were impaired as it relates to the cerebellum. So I'm going to break down these four areas and show you some of the research. One of the really exciting things that came out in 1998 was movement analysis in infancy. Dr. Philip Teitelbaum looked at videotapes of children with autism, and in this analysis, each of the children showed some degree of movement disturbance related to major milestones, major developmental milestones, and we'll look at those in a minute. He looked at 17 videos of children with autism, and he used the Eshkol-Wachman movement notation analysis as compared to 15 typical infants. And the Eshkol-Wachman system uses spherical coordinates applied to different segments of the body and discriminates between active movements and passive movements to then identify what movements are abnormal. So this list is a list of developmental milestones and the things that they analyzed in these videos. Lying, the way a baby would lie and posture, they showed persistent asymmetry and deviations in how they extended their arms, how they postured their neck. When they looked at writing, and in this case, it's rolling over. When a baby is learning to roll over, they showed passive segmentation of moving versus a typical baby will kind of corkscrew movement. They'll activate their shoulder, those muscles as they rotate their shoulder, and then their hips rotate, and then they bring their legs over. It's this corkscrew movement. In children with autism, they get the first part initiated, and then their legs would just be carried over passively. In sitting, they displayed asymmetrical posturing and or could not sustain a seated position at a developmentally appropriate age. In crawling, they showed an asymmetrical lack of adequate arm support as well as asymmetry in the legs, where the left side actively carried a passive right side through the movement. So it's very interesting. I mean, a lot of children with autism either don't crawl or they crawl in a different manner. And so they saw these abnormalities in these developmental milestones. In some of the videos, some of the children stood for an abnormal length of time in posture, which may be indicative of the inability to initiate movement. And then walking and gait, the arms and legs moved asymmetrically. Development of a normal pattern of walking was delayed, and or the sequencing of gait was present, but there was a delay in weight shift. So they noticed these developmental milestones, and, you know, I think it's exciting. I think some pediatricians are starting to see this, but it was such a small number of cases. I mean, they looked at 17 videos, and I know there's been some further research looking at video analyses, but there's just not a lot of evidence besides these 17. I mean, I think it's pretty impressive that in all 17 cases, they showed some of this passivity and some of this asymmetry. So gait abnormalities in autism, mild clumsiness, upper limb posturing, decreased range of motion of the ankle, and decreased knee flexion in early stances. So they're looking at children with autism and how they move and how they carry their body as they're walking. So there's that mild clumsiness and just decreased range of motion. There was gait variability, there was poor coordination, and lack of motor smoothness. Now, what's, you know, cool for the purposes of looking at the cerebellum is that their gait parameters overall appeared normal. They are able to walk. They're able to move. Their velocity, their cadence, and their step width were within normal range, which indicates cerebellar dysfunction, because what is missing in their gait is that coordination, that smoothness of movement, and that kind of regulatory movement that's necessary for efficiency. So children with autism showed an increased cadence than typical peers. What your cadence is your steps per minute. How many steps do we walk? And we all have a different cadence. I'm, as you can probably tell by the speed of my voice, I walk a little faster than most people. But children with autism showed, compared to typical peers, that their cadence was a little bit faster. Their preferred gait conditions were also slightly faster. When they were asked to walk at their preferred speed or just walk at a comfortable pace, it was faster than typical children. In another study with Reinhardt in 2006, there was also support of this cerebellar damage theory in autism, because they were not able to modify their gait based on visual markers. They were not able to take that external stimuli and respond to it as a typical child would. So the deficits that they saw in locomotion, in gait, in autism, were a disturbance in the maintenance of a regular rhythm and an automatic locomotor pattern. But again, the gait parameters and balance were unaffected. So, and then secondly, they saw an impaired ability to motor plan. The experimenter imposed an action, and the children in this case were unable to plan the route necessary toward the goal. So again, those gait parameters overall appear to be modified, but not necessarily significant compared to norms. But these variables may be used to understand the neurobiological basis in autism and may be beneficial for clinical and diagnostic understanding. So another area that was identified in the research in movement differences in autism was impaired performance of skilled motor gestures. So children with autism show impairments in these three areas: impaired performance of gestures on command, impaired gestures with imitation, and impaired gestures with tool use. The greatest impairment was gestures to command, but their performance improved with imitation and tool use. And this is similar to a pattern of impairment seen in adults with acquired idiomotor apraxia. Motor initiation problems are common in autism, and this commonality suggests that there may be a broader motor problem. It may not just be imitation, but what else is going on in movement? It's also important to note that imitation in autism is more impaired in younger children and or those with lower developmental levels, and they exhibited an increase in difficulty imitating non-meaningful gestures than meaningful ones in comparison with controls. So if you have a child who shows difficulty imitating movements, you might try using more meaningful gestures such as waving to daddy. It's the only example I can think of right now, but more meaningful gestures than something that has no meaning to them, no functional meaning. The definition of a gesture is the ability to perform skilled motor acts or sequences of purposeful movements and the ability to use tools. And in this case, we're talking tools like, you know, can you brush your hair with the brush? Can you brush your teeth? And what's interesting is children with autism showed improvement in motor ability when they had the tool in hand. If you all, now I can't see any of you, but if you all would pretend right now to brush your teeth, pretend like you're brushing your teeth, and I want you to look at what you're doing with your hand, how you're holding your hand, positioning your hand. Most of you are probably leaving space in your hand, like that toothbrush is actually in your hand based on the kind of toothbrush you use. Now, children with autism without the tool had a really difficult time initiating and demonstrating that skill. So what a lot of them did was make their hand into the tool. So some of you out there may actually have stuck out your finger like a toothbrush and pretended to brush your teeth that way. So with the tool, children with autism did better. Without it, they tried to accommodate for that by creating the tool, but still showed deficits in that demonstration of the motor output. So imitation deficits are considered universal and specific in autism. Results of all of these studies, support a generalized praxis deficit rather than they're just solely motor deficits. They're showing that there's something else going on because they have motor skills. They have the ability to demonstrate, to execute motor tasks. They can walk across the room. They can pick things up. As Rimlin said, they can build towers. They can climb tall, you know, playground structures. But what we're looking at is a generalized praxis deficit. Now, dyspraxia is a term that's borrowed from adult neurology, describing adults with acquired brain lesions demonstrating impaired ability to perform motor skill tasks, the most studied type being idiomotor apraxia, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. So many of you probably know that a consistent report in children with autism is developmental dyspraxia. And this is a disorder in gestural performance associated with deficits in performance of meaningful gestures, non-meaningful gestures, and gesture sequences to verbal command and imitation. So many children with autism show this developmental dyspraxia, but again, I think it's fascinating that movement differences in autism is so controversial because in some cases, this is part of their diagnosis. So what does that mean? Let me go back to dyspraxia. The root of that word is praxis. What does that include? It includes ideation, motor planning, and execution. So it the idea of what you're going to move, what you're going to do, and then how do you motor plan that action, and then how do you execute it? So if I'm laying in bed this morning and my alarm goes off and I know I need to roll over, I need to hit the snooze button and roll back over. So I get the idea in my head that I'm going to roll over to stretch my arm out to hit that snooze button, and I'll tell you I do it like 3 or 4 times. And then I motor plan to make my body get there, and I then I execute that action. So one of the big parts of skilled motor performance is psychomotor regulation and psychomotor responses. They are involved in skilled motor performance. So what are psychomotor response or psychomotor regulation components? What are they? It's initiation of movement, sustaining of movement, inhibition of movement, switching movements, or combining movements. And this is also referred to as perceptual motor responses. If you've heard that, psychomotor or perceptual motor are the same thing. This is how do you start your body? How do you sustain movement through the task that you're doing? And how do you stop your body? So let's just look at those three things quickly. When you start your body, let's think about your own children, or for therapists out there or teachers out there, think about, you know, children in your class or that you see in therapy sessions. When you ask them to do something, are they able to initiate that movement? If you ask them to get up and walk to the, you know, to the door to go to the lunchroom, do they initiate that movement? Or do they initiate it, but then they don't sustain? They can't get all the way there. Or do they get up and they are moving and they can't inhibit? They can't stop that movement as they're just walking constantly around the room or around the kitchen table for dinner. How are they able to, you know, look at those three, you know, how do they start, how do they sustain, and how do they stop? Unfortunately, again, based on the diagnostic criteria in autism, a lot of people think that if you say, Johnny, stand up and walk across the room, we're going to lunch, and he doesn't get up, does he not understand? Is that what's going on? He just doesn't understand what they're asking him. Well, this look at autism, we don't think so. We think that he just is unable to regulate his psychomotor responses and get his body up and moving. So how does he initiate, how does he sustain, and how does he inhibit? Those are the three main areas that you can look at people that you work with or children in your own home and start identifying where you might see that breakdown. Now, when you switch or you combine movements, then it gets even trickier. So when you're asking a more complex task from someone that you are working with, how do they switch their movements within a task, and how do they combine maybe their upper body and their lower body as needed? So again, this I'm looking primarily at motor, but psychomotor regulation is really the cognitive control over motor output. So it's not can they move their bodies, it's that fine-tuned control over it. And when we go back to that cerebellar loop that goes up, and just so you know, I'm talking with my hands and no one can benefit from that right now, but it's not translating, I don't think. But when that connectivity from the cerebellum goes up to the frontal lobe and comes back, the frontal lobe is really your cognitive, you know, what's the other, another word for that? Your, sorry, it escapes me right now, but your higher level, kind of more executive functioning, higher level control. So it's, again, you know, that's that breakdown in that cerebellar loop may be contributing to these this lack of regulation of psychomotor responses. So psychomotor responses can impact motor, as we've talked about, so that relates to actions. But just for you to consider, it also can impact emotions. So you might have a child that is really happy to see you, but they can't regulate that, and so they either get really excited and giddy and they can't control their bodies and they're running around and so happy that you're there, or they may burst into tears. And it may not be that they aren't happy to see you, but they can't regulate that response. They overshoot that response. Or they undershoot, as we talked about earlier, and there's absolutely no affect. And so it's like, well, maybe he just doesn't like me. We think that it's actually that they're unable to regulate those responses. So it can impact actions, emotions, thoughts, memories, speech, speech is motor. It's a different part of the brain, but it is motor. And so you're going to see difficulty regulating speech output, verbal output. Postures, a lot of the kids that I see work, like get stuck in postures where they're either, you know, they might be in their chair and they've crossed their leg and they're leaning against their thighs. And what we look at that as an accommodation. So maybe they have a hard time inhibiting and they know their body's going to be up and across the room. So they get in this posture and then they're unable to get out of that posture without someone facilitating them through that. The other, another area that can be impacted is perception. So again, I'm going to focus more on motor, but it's important to consider those things as it relates to initiation, inhibition, and sustaining. So impairments in motor coordination and praxis in autism are indicative of neurological abnormalities resulting from a reduction in Purkinje cells and or connectivity between the cerebellum and the frontal parietal regions. So another area that was looked at in movement were motor planning deficits in autism. And in a study by Reinhardt and colleagues in 2001, they showed intact ability to execute movement, but they lacked anticipation while preparing movement. Their findings in this were that the clumsy label in autism may be more of an issue with poorly planned movement. So how do they motor plan? Another study in 2003, it was a bimanual load lifting task where they had to transfer from one arm and one hand some weighted object to the other hand. And how did the children with autism respond? Well, they showed insufficient postural anticipation. And really interestingly, they showed a slowing down of movement involved in the lift. And what that indicates is a feedback approach versus a feed-forward approach. So the cerebellum is constantly has this feed-forward approach of what's going on in the environment, what's the external stimuli, what is my intention, what is the action, how do I take all that information and assimilate it to get the movement that I want. And what children with autism showed is this slowing down in their movement, which they believe was compensation because it gave them proprioceptive feedback. Proprioception is your joint muscle input. It gave them that extra input to aid in postural stability. So it's a great accommodation, but it shows that they are finding an accommodation for these observed motor planning deficits. They showed in this study that building of internal representations may be a primary impairment due to a lack of anticipatory mode of control. So again, if we go back, let me see if I can go back really quick to some of the things that Leo Kanner saw in his early findings, early observations. Where is it? Give me just a second. All right. He saw, you know, failure to assume an anticipatory posture, the lack of ability to adjust their body to the person holding them, marked limitation in the variety of spontaneous activity, that motor performances were repetitive. And what the research is showing is that despite what the requested task was, if it was, and I'm going to get to this probably in the next slide, but if they had to chain motor responses, what they showed was that in a typical person, as you got to the third movement, whatever the last movement was, it changed the speed of your first movement. So in the typical brain, in a typical cerebellum, you chain those motor actions together and form an internal representation to then be able to output. In autism, they showed this repetitive movement that did not change due to whatever the third movement was. I wish I could see your faces and see if that makes sense. So let me go back to where we were. Can everybody just say, yeah, I got it?
Yeah.
Thanks, Nancy. So Now, I think we're back here. So, again, let me back up, that they believe that this internal representation is an impairment. They're not able to develop those internal representations because of a lack of anticipatory motive control. So, in another study, Gidley Larson in 2008 looked at modifying information in the environment and how would that impact those internal models? Were they able to represent that? And in self-generated movements and movements that they decided on their own, or they, the children with autism in the study that they initiated on their own, their acquisition and adaptation of internal models appeared normal. So it appears that the function of adaptation is preserved at the expense of other cerebellar functions, because we have to survive, we have to be able to adapt to what's going on in the environment. So it shows that there are compensatory mechanisms that may exist leading to normal adaptation. So I just talked about this when I was having a hard time finding my slides. In a motor sequencing task, they showed a deficit in children with autism in chaining those motor acts into a global plan, but rather programmed the individual acts independently from one another. So there's another article out, and I don't remember the person's name. I want to say Haswell. That looked at this global plan. Is it truly that they're not seeing the global plan and they're just independently performing those acts one at a time? Or is it that the timing is interrupted, the timing is irregular, atypical in autism based on the cerebellar model, and that they are piecing those movements not necessarily separately, but they are using their internal timing to the best of their ability, and they get stuck in that repetitive movement pattern that Leo Kanner talked about, and that some of the research has shown that this movement gets stuck. There's an example, a colleague of mine, Kathleen Berger, did a video analysis of a child with autism and a typical child as they were learning to feed with a spoon. And the child with autism would get into this postured, like his elbow would be out, his hand would, you know, move to that, would bring the spoon to his mouth and back to the bowl, and back to his mouth and back to the bowl. And there was no change in the movement. He had to stay in that movement pattern. Whereas a typical child, as they're learning to eat, they're picking up the spoon, putting their food in, they kind of twist their wrist. They, you know, might bring their elbow into their body and their wrist is out, you know, the spoon is outward. This is really where I need a visual for you, but where they just have more flexibility in their movement, and not flexibility in their, in a muscle motor way, but they're able to have irregularity in their movement and adjust and adapt. And if daddy comes walking in and says something, they can turn and look. But the child with autism, if an external cue came in, if dad walked by, they were then, that movement got disrupted and they had to start again and get back into that routine. So it may not be that the chaining of motor acts is a deficit. It may be that it's a timing issue. So functional neuroimaging in autism during motor tasks showed that the cerebellum activation was consistent with as it would be in a typical person, but the spatial extent and magnitude of activation in the cerebellum was greater during motor execution. And additionally, activation in areas not typically associated with motor tasks happened. So there was activation in areas, I believe, in the frontal lobe, that you might not see in a typical person in a simple motor task. So functional differences may be a reflection of cerebellar anatomic abnormality and then subsequent compensatory strategies. Decreased cerebellar activation paired with an increase in premotor activation indicated as well that there were anatomical or functional abnormalities. So sometimes they saw decreased cerebellar activation, but then an increase in the premotor area, which is in the frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe and the cerebellum may be domain compatible, and thus the frontal lobe may compensate for lack of activation in the cerebellum. And this, you might look at this, excuse me, similar to someone that is blind, that doesn't have that visual information, their auditory system is going to compensate and become stronger because they don't have that visual sense. Well, the frontal lobe may compensate for the lack of the atypical development in the cerebellum. So to recap, looking at movement, again, Ann Donnellan's slide is that I mentioned earlier, her definition of movement disturbance is an interference in the efficient, effective use of movement that cannot be accounted for by paralysis or weakness, synonymous with a disruption in the regulation of movement. So your regulation of movement is going to be impacted by those psychomotor responses that stems from that cerebellar frontal lobe loop. So the evidence supports that there are movement differences in autism and that they stem from cerebellar abnormality. So if, you know, this is the case and the research is showing this, would rhythm and neurologic music therapy be a useful tool for children with autism or people with autism? So neurologic music therapy is an advanced level training in music therapy, and it's defined as the therapeutic application of music to cognitive, sensory, and motor dysfunctions due to disease or disability. This treatment approach is based on neuroscience models of music perception and the influence of music on non-musical behavior. So the research that they looked at four levels. It's called the rational scientific mediating model. And what is happening in the brain when you're doing a strictly music experience, processing music, listening to music, what's happening in the brain in those areas? What's happening in the brain in another level of this, in motor tasks or in speech or in a cognitive task? And then they look at those parallels. What is similar in the brain when they're processing music or listening to music or performing music? And then what's happening in the brain when we're doing functional tasks? And what are those parallels? And if those parallels exist, then can we apply music and rhythm to impact change? So this paradigm really looked at how does rhythm impact movement. This is some of the initial findings in neurologic music therapy. And these findings were pretty exciting. They showed that in rhythmicity and brain research, there is evidence that interaction between auditory rhythm and motor responses can be effectively employed for rehabilitation. What that means is that, and I'll probably be redundant because it's probably in the next slide, but auditory rhythm, so either rhythm on a metronome, rhythm from a computer, you know, a set auditory cue, this can drive motor responses. Sorry. Okay, so rhythm and motor control. What the research showed is that the motor system is physiologically very sensitive to arousal by the auditory system, that rhythm can facilitate positive change in motor output, that rhythm not only affects the timing of movement, but the total movement pattern, and that auditory rhythmic cues add stability in motor control immediately within two or three stimuli rather than through a gradual learning process. So I want to throw out a couple of quick things. Some of you may be familiar with the interactive metronome. This is a tool that is used in occupational therapy. It's a program where you tap to this external cue, and you have to tap on the beat. This may be an effective tool if someone is working on cognition and really working on regulating that cognitive control, but it does not impact motor in the same way. It's not motor when you have to tap to the beat because you've made it purely a cognitive task. You're listening and you're responding to that tap that you're hearing. So it may work, but it is not going to affect, I don't believe, the movement in the way that having a rhythm in the background that you're not necessarily aware of. We all kind of, you know, are in the grocery store and we hear music and we might tap our foot or tap our hand as we're waiting in line. We're not aware of the impact that those auditory rhythmic cues can have on our motor. And in the research specifically for neurologic music therapy, they looked at, you know, tapping responses. If a person was tapping on the table, they had two targets, and they're tapping their middle finger to one target to the next target, to one target to the next target. As they modified the metronome signal even slightly, just, you know, so slight that the human ear can't perceive the change, the body responded. The motor impact was changed. So it's pretty exciting how impacting rhythm can be on motor. So they also showed that rhythmic synchronization of neural, auditory, and motor impulses is based on entrainment to the auditory signal frequency. Now, that just is a lot of words that don't mean a lot to a lot of people. What that says is that, as I go back to that interactive metronome example, you are not just trying to tap on the beat. Rhythm provides time information across the duration of the movement and not just the endpoints of movement. So what the brain does is responds to that interval of time between the beats. So if the tap is tap, 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 your brain is adjusting right now for the space between the beats. And in some cases, when there's motor dysfunction, the person that's demonstrating the motor output may actually be slightly off the beat. But if you measure the interval of time between the beats, they are responding. And as a therapist, it's been kind of a fun little journey. You know, if I was working with a child with autism and having them play the drum to work on, you know, functional regulation of movement, and they're getting their body going, they're playing the drum, and I'm playing with their beat, what I have found is that they often get slightly off the beat, and then I would adjust to go with them, and again, they'd get slightly off. And what we found as clinicians is that if we maintain that rhythmic structure, then they were able to sustain because of that frequency entrainment. Their brains were responding to the period of time between the beats, that interval of time, and not just the actual beat. And as I mentioned earlier, rhythm can influence you on subliminal levels. So you may not be aware that you're tapping your foot until someone says, hey, could you knock that off? You're shaking the table. So frequency entrainment allows the brain to map and scale smoother time parameters of position change due to the precise reference interval. And auditory information acts as a forcing function in motor control toward optimization and efficiency of kinematic movement patterns. So we, in neurologic music therapy, there is a lot of research supporting using rhythm as an auditory stimulus to entrain motor function. So in a lot of studies with Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, stroke, traumatic brain injury, and in an unpublished paper with cerebellar ataxia, there were improvements through rhythmic cueing in gait parameters, specifically cadence, velocity, and stride length. And they've seen a difference in fluency of movement and regulation of movement. So based on these models, we think that neurologic music therapy is a great tool for people with autism because it can help with that regulation of movement. So the effectiveness of neurologic music therapy, or NMT, is based on the fact that music is not cortically distinct, but rather shares cortical networks activated in similar non-musical tasks. For example, speech and singing use similar cortical areas. And I talked about that earlier, those parallels. You find those parallels, and then music can influence the response. So if someone is not speaking, you might get more verbal output or vocal output through music. Secondly, there's optimization of cortical networks. And what that means in cognition, motor movement, and speech, cortical networks, with rhythm or music, there has been shown music and rhythm can recruit or extend additional areas and increase neuronal synchronization. So adding music or rhythm will help to fire those neurons and help this neural synchronization that otherwise might not happen. Additionally, music has been shown to drive cortical plasticity, effectively changing the brain that is engaged in music. Dr. Michael Tout, who is the founder, basically, of neurologic music therapy, has a great quote, "The brain that engages in music is changed by engaging in music." So every time you listen to music or your child listens to music or there's rhythm, the brain is being changed by that in some way. So it's important to be aware of your responses and your child's responses or your client's responses when music is playing. So engagement in music has been shown to drive non-musical learning through optimized networks, promoting changes in non-musical skills. So that's the main function of neurologic music therapy, is to use rhythm and music to impact functional change. How is it going to impact movement regulation? How is it going to impact communication or cognition? So one easy example that you're all familiar with in how children learn with musical stimuli is learning the alphabet with the ABC song. So when we look at the rhythm and the cerebellum in the typical brain, we're going to, the vital element linking music to motor behavior is time. And the cerebellum's main role is this timekeeper role. So what research has shown in various auditory motor cueing studies is that the cerebellar cortex and the vermis, those vermal lobules, contribute to the production of a timed motor response. And that the cerebellum may aid in computing the temporal parameters, so the timing of incoming sensory stimuli and outgoing movements, as well as in novel, temporally precise motor responses. Now, based on this, one would think that individuals with cerebellar impairment would show deficits in timing, particularly as it relates to practice, to initiating, planning, executing that movement. But contrastingly, that's not what was found in patients with cerebellar impairment. Timing processes in the motor domain in relation to rhythmic auditory cues were unimpaired. So that says that using an external rhythmic cue aided in those timing responses in patients that had cerebellar impairment. Motor entrainment to rhythmic stimuli was fundamentally intact in individuals with cerebellar damage. And that entrainment, again, is that response to that frequency matching, that interval of time between the beats. Cerebellar damaged patients immediately adapted to subtle and unperceivable changes in rhythm to the synchronized motor response, and they tapped slightly ahead of the metronome beat, which is indicative of anticipation, as healthy subjects do. So individuals that have cerebellar damage who showed lack of anticipation with this external rhythmic cue, auditory rhythmic cue, they were able to have responses very similar to healthy subjects. So now when you look at vermal lobules 6 and 7, which are two of the areas that have hypoplasia in the autism brain, in the cerebellum, those two lobules are connected to visual and auditory senses. In activation of lobule 6, it was revealed that there were time-sensitive responses to modifications of the rhythmic tempo. So if there was a change in the rhythmic tempo, that lobule 6 activated. In novel and or complex tasks, there was incrementally larger activation in these lobules. So if these lobules are in fact hypoplastic, if they're smaller or underdeveloped, then rhythmic auditory cueing may facilitate activations in these areas to elicit shared networks for motor performance, or if needed, may provide compensatory accommodations to activate other areas. So it's pretty exciting. Rhythm may be a wonderful tool. I mean, clinically we've seen this. Let me just say that clinically we have seen that this rhythm is an incredible tool for persons with autism. But at this point, there's not enough research to show that. So we're working on that. So the cerebellum, the proposed function is to adjust motor output related to planned actions. This feed-forward approach predicts the timing of an upcoming movement, utilizes sensory feedback from the current movement, and compares ongoing performance to an internal model, and then adapts responses such as force and or trajectory. So the cerebellum, as comparator, has this feed-forward approach. And we talked about previously that children with autism had used proprioception as a feedback mechanism in those motor bimanual load lifting tasks. So interestingly, the posterior cerebellar vermis, which are those lobules that are affected in autism, may coordinate proprioceptive input from muscle stress receptors to optimize motor control. So when the child with autism gets that extra proprioceptive feedback, they are activating those cerebellar vermal lobules. Another interesting thing is that auditory feedback has been utilized to aid in proprioceptive muscular control. So one of the studies I have listed here had it was an amputee, and he had a robotic hand, and auditory cueing was able to provide feedback to gain muscular control when there was no proprioceptive feedback available. So rhythmic auditory stimuli may then create a feed-forward interaction as the auditory system directly influences the motor output in a predictive way, allowing the person with autism to move more efficiently and fluently without reliance on other sensory feedback such as proprioception. So the use of rhythm in autism. Rhythm may facilitate sensory motor synchronization in autism and contribute to improved gross motor functioning, so that coordination and fluency of movement, and it may aid in psychomotor responses, initiation, sustaining, inhibition, transitioning. We saw, after the first neurologic music therapy training, a group of colleagues and I went to this first training, and we came back and started using metronomes throughout our sessions, and we saw that there was much less need for other sensory supports. And there was, such as proprioception, such as deep pressure, such as vestibular touch cues, there was a decrease in the need for that with that external auditory rhythmic cueing. Now, we didn't necessarily understand why, but I think based on the research now, we do understand that. So if you use rhythm to pair with other sensory supports, then you're going to maximize the impact on your child. So using rhythm for anticipatory preparation of movement, this is a deficit that was looked at in autism. Deficits of anticipation were identified, and it may be due to a lack of internal cueing. When you have internal pacing of movement, it is a higher demand on the motor system than external pacing. And auditory rhythmic stimuli can serve as predictable timing cues that influence motor anticipation, resulting in the response pattern gradually becoming automatic. So with praxis deficits, rhythm can be used to lessen the demands, again, because internal cueing creates more demand, while providing precise reference intervals at each stage of the movement. And it can promote fluency and accuracy of movement patterns and organize the overall movement sequence. So these areas, based on what the research shows, may be functional goals for movement differences in autism: gait function, motor coordination, motor planning, and functional motor skill development. Now, gait function, I have this little asterisk there because gait is not significantly abnormal in autism and it's functional, it is probably not a goal that a therapist would work on. But looking at the child that they work with or your child, how they move may be a really wonderful tool in identifying the greater movement issues that are going on. A common theme in many useful interventions across many different disciplines is the use of environmental accommodations that provide a consistent pattern of sensory, motor, attentional, emotional, or some other type of modulation. And that is what a consistent rhythmic pattern does. It creates that consistent pattern, that consistent cue, to allow for increased efficiency and output of motor. So because motor disorders are among the earliest identifiable features in autism, I believe Teitelbaum's earliest look was at a 6-month-old child, before social or communication deficits are evident, further research in this area could provide a useful supplement to current diagnostic measures in autism. So looking at movement could really impact the child that you're serving, or your own child, because you can intervene at a much younger age if you're looking purely at movement, and then that hopefully would lessen the severity of symptoms in autism based on early intervention. As movement differences are indisputable based on current evidence in autism, and motor signs are distinctly quantifiable and reproducible, evaluations of movement might serve as effective comparisons for deficits in parallel systems important for socialization and communication. So if you think about the timing that's involved in speech production, speech motor for speech is very it's very fine, and it requires, you know, much control over timing. And so rhythm might, you know, looking at movement differences and impacting movement through rhythm may impact the timing in speech production, or it may influence the child's ability to predict and respond to social cues in the moment, in the environment, and then to execute a motor response. Like if you have to get up and greet a friend, you know, movement is going to impact other areas than just motor. It can play a part in socialization and communication and even cognition. Being that if you look at an IQ test, you need speech and motor to demonstrate your skill level. And these areas, if they're impaired in autism, you're not going to get a true representation in in the scoring. It's not going to be a true representation of the child's ability. So research is greatly needed to assess the use of rhythm within this population, keeping in mind that autism is a developmental disability and therefore different than rehabilitative cerebellar models. Now, until research is done, motor should not be ignored. It should still be looked at, as it may be, it may indicate other areas of need. So I have two video examples that we're going to get to in just a minute, and then we'll have time for questions. As I mentioned earlier, I, about 2 weeks ago, completed my master's degree at Colorado State University and had the privilege of having Dr. Temple Grandin on my committee. And she asked some great questions and really wanted to know what, you know, how do you apply this and what are the functional outcomes? You know, she really wanted to know what were going to be the results for children. And so she had me select one rhythmic intervention that I might use in therapy and talk about why I thought that would work. And so she was awesome and agreed to participate in this intervention. So I'm going to show you two examples of Temple Grandin drumming with me, and I want you just to look at a couple of things while you're watching. I'm not sure which video is going to come first. There's one where she's holding mallets or sticks to play the drums, and in both cases, she's crossing midline, which is a sensory integrative developmental milestone that I think when you're crawling is when you first get that integration, and it basically sends messages from each hemisphere. So it's a very integrative experience. So she's crossing midline. She's having to visually attend. She's having to walk, move forward and backwards. So she's initiating movement. She's sustaining movement. She's inhibiting movement. She's having to switch and combine because she's using her upper body and her lower body. And you can see there is dysregulation in her movement as she's doing this. Now, we had done this a couple different ways and a couple different times. And at one point, I'm counting for her to give her that cognitive control over her movement. So I'm going to have you look at them, and then we're going to take questions. So thank you for your time. I'm sorry if I talked too quickly. But
no, that's fine. Everybody that's watching via the web can go to their blue box. And there's a link to the videos. It says show videos of Michelle Hardy's presentation. Click that, and then you'll go to a box that has both videos. Just go ahead and play them one at a time. One's a minute 28 seconds, and the other one is 25 seconds. Okay, I finished the videos.
Okay.
I hope most people have. Okay, I'm going to go to the screen with our questions. If anybody's calling in on the phone and would like to ask a question directly to Michelle, you can press *2, and that will alert me that you have a question. In the meantime, I'll go to the Q&As that have been coming in through the web, and I'll ask a couple of those questions while we're waiting. Michelle from Portland asks, what activities can I do to help my 3 to 5-year-olds in my class? I'm a teacher at a school of autism, and I need ideas and suggestions.
Great question, Michelle. I think that 3 to 5-year-olds need a lot of movement, and that's, you know, partly how they develop, you know, their identity and influence their social and communicative and cognitive skills. I would suggest spending time, you know, you can use music in your classroom, but really looking at the simplicity of the music, having it be a strong rhythmic base, a strong rhythmic foundation, and not a lot of extra, you know, a lot of kids' music is pretty simple and has a predictable rhythm. But I would do a lot of stop-start things, you know, getting them to initiate their bodies, be it that they're walking around the classroom and they have to stop, and then they have to run around the classroom and stop. You know, doing different kinds of movement that will help regulate their psychomotor responses, but also giving them sensory feedback. You know, any kind of animal walks to music, bear walks, crab walks, crawling, all of those types of movement are really integrative. And when you have that rhythmic external cue, you're going to help with the integration of their responses. You can do things where, you know, they're patting their legs in a group if they're sitting there. You know, they're patting with you as you're, you know, going through your circle time, or they're clapping or they're stomping. Again, those things are going to give proprioceptive feedback, but it's going to be fun for them. It's very age-appropriate. But I think that 3 to 5-year-old age range is a really important time. They're still figuring out who they are, and they're probably having a hard time regulating their bodies. And so if you can practice a lot of that stop-start stuff, and sometimes when it's not predictable, you know, you have the music on and you, or you have just a metronome going, and you, you know, just verbally tell them to stop their bodies and freeze and hold that for different durations of time to allow for them to have success when they're unable to predict the response. I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does, at least to me. can you tell me the difference between just using a metronome in music and interactive metronome?
Yes, the interactive metronome is a specific program. It's a marketed program. A metronome is just, you know, you probably can think of the old school metronomes when a piano player is practicing that kind of tick-tocks to the side. It's like a triangular shape, and there's a metal piece that goes back and forth. Well, children with autism tend to respond to visual stimuli, and that would probably be a distraction in whatever environment you're in. And so having an electronic metronome that has a, and I don't have mine here, I'd let you hear it, that has a kind of a warm tone to it, and just set that on, and it's just going to have like a click, 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 click. My metronome also has a volume control, and that's also, you know, some children with autism are hypersensitive to sound, and so being able to control that as well, or if you're in a group versus a one-to-one setting, you can adjust the volume based on your environment. So the interactive metronome is something specific where you are targeting a response to a computer program, and this is just having that, a metronome is just having that external cue in the environment.
And you would have that on during the music or just on by itself?
I would probably either have it going by itself or, I mean, if you're putting a CD in for your, back to the 3 to 5-year-old class, I would probably not have both of them going because you're going to have a strong rhythmic structure, and then you're going to have to adjust the metronome to make sure it's at the same cadence as or tempo as the CD, and that would just, it would be too much and confusing stimuli.
Okay. Are there different types of music therapy? Is neurologic music therapy like a different sector? Or are all music therapists?
They are different. Music therapists practice in an evidence-based paradigm, and there are different branches of that. Neurologic music therapy is really looking at rhythm and rehabilitation of movement, although that that crosses over to developmental disabilities as well, and there's research within the neurologic music therapy paradigm. But there are different branches of or different advanced level trainings in music therapy, like there's guided imagery. There's prenatal care and specific evidence and research for those areas. This seems to me to be the most well-rounded. Autism is my passion and my interest, and so I think it's the most well-rounded as it relates to motor disorders and communication, cognition, and sensory.
Okay. And do you suggest having music playing in the background while someone's doing a learning activity?
I think it depends on the child. It depends on the person. But yes, I think it can be very helpful. There's a lot of research to support rhythm with attention deficit, that it can provide that external, that auditory scaffolding. But I think, in autism, having that rhythm in the background might be for different reasons. It would probably be more to regulate their psychomotor responses to allow them to maintain their bodies where they need to be. But in some cases, it could be to facilitate attention. So you just need to look at the person that you're referring to, and do they need music in the background? Depending on the age of their child, a 14-year-old child with high-functioning autism might be able to say, hey, this music really helps me. Let's put that on when I'm doing my homework. But you can watch your child's responses. If you put on music that's a pretty fast tempo and they get really hyped up, then that's probably not the kind of music you want to put on when you're working on a cognitive task, homework, or whatever.
Okay. We had a question come in from India.
Hi, rhythmic India.
Movement help for speech?
Rhythm, yes. There is research to support that rhythm can impact speech production. For the purposes of this presentation and for what I did for my thesis, it was too much information. It was too broad to go from speech to motor, and they are different areas of the brain. But neurologic music therapy in particular has several specific techniques using rhythm and music to influence speech production.
Okay. Rebecca from Cleveland asks, what types of assessments do you use to determine how or where to start?
Good question. It depends on what you have access to. I think an occupational therapy assessment is a great place. Is this a parent?
She says that she's a music therapist, and she has two kids with autism.
Okay. I think a lot of it is, if you have access to an occupational therapist who does praxis testing and can look at really the motor system and how it's responding, they have standardized tools to look at that, and then you can influence based on that. Some of the neurologic music therapy approach is looking at how does a child respond with music and how does a child respond without music, so you can see the influence of rhythm or music. Simply, you can look at a child's gait and how many steps per minute they demonstrate and set a metronome to that and see how that impacts. I worked with a child once who picked up my metronome. He was he's a great guy. I mean, he's now 19 years old, and when he first came to work with me, he was just constantly in motion, and he just couldn't sit down. And the occupational therapy, we were in a camp environment. I'm a director of Chris's camp, and the occupational therapist could not get the child to sit to assess fine motor and other motor skill level. And so he came into my session, picked up my metronome, turned it on, and sat down for the whole session. And then we passed the metronome around, and he was able to sit. and demonstrate his skill level. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, mm-hmm. but ask me a different one if I didn't answer it.
A couple of people have asked, can you describe some more of the activities that you typically will do? We saw on the video the one activity with the drums and the drumsticks or hands. What other kinds of activities might you do?
I often do, especially with young children, like I mentioned to Michelle, for the 3 to 5 year olds, lots of proprioceptive feedback movements. And I will structure my music on the guitar based on the movement, so it helps to facilitate that response. So if it's a bear walk, it would be like bump, chick, as they're moving their arms and their legs. If it's crawling, I'm going to have a more steady bum, 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 bum to facilitate that hand, hand, knee, knee, hand, hand. So a lot of movement stuff that way. Also a lot of start, stop. So if it's playing the drum and, you know, playing with sticks, playing with, with your hands. Grasping mallets is often more difficult than just playing with your hands and just having that, working on that regulation piece. We do a lot of crossing midline. I'm trying to think of what else. I mean, there are other things that I do that are not motor specific that I don't want to, you know, if I'm working on communication or cognition, but I don't want to go into that because I feel like that's not what this presentation was for.
Uh-huh.
So as it relates to psychomotor responses, really any kind of stop, start, sustaining, having to switch, either having to switch your mallet from one hand to the other hand, just allowing for integration and coordination of movements.
Okay, we are running out of time, so I want to know if there's a place where people can get more information and ask you questions.
Sure, you can email me. I'll give you a website you can go to. It's www.chriscamp.org, chriscamp.org. And on that website, you can find the contact us link. And click on that, and it has my my email address as well as my cell phone. I'd prefer email. I don't know how many of you are out there. I don't want to field 1,000 calls, but I would be happy to email you. And Chris's Camp is an intensive therapy camp for children with autism that I've worked at for many, many years. So that's probably the quickest way to get me.
Very nice. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and sharing all this important information. It really, a couple of important points hit home for me, and I've got some new things to try, and I think other people as well will be out there doing some rhythmic movement next week.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for doing this. This is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me very much. Appreciate it.
I also want to let everyone know that if you want a transcript of this event, you can join our Spectrum Gold Club. There should be a button on your screen if you're logged into the website. We will send you a copy of this webinar audio and transcript and 29 other webinars when you join. Also, be sure and tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial.